てくださったそうですね。これで3年8組なんと47名もう辛いことも苦しいこともありません。安らかに眠ってください。
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to another episode of It's Crime Time. This episode is the third in my mini-series of crimes that keep me up at night. I originally decided to do two and then had kind of forgotten that this was one of the cases that really bothered me as well. So I'm placing this in here because it kind of goes in line with the other two cases that I've done. And I remember only hearing about this case once or twice a long time ago, and it just kind of popped back into my mind, I guess because we were on the subject of torture in the last two episodes. So I am doing covering the case of Junko Furuta on today's episode. All right, everyone, it's crime time. In the beginning of this episode, you heard a small excerpt in Japanese from Junko's funeral, and that was her friend, by the way, just as a note here. And another thing before I continue this episode, I want to place a disclaimer here, as this episode is extremely graphic. It involves serious torture and crimes on a minor, so if you feel that you cannot handle it, please feel free to click off. I'm going to apologize ahead of time, I do not speak a lot of Japanese. I am kind of one of those nerds. I'm into a lot of anime and Japanese games and things of that nature, but I apologize if I mispronounce any of these words in here or names. Junko Furuta was born in Misada, Saitama Prefecture in Japan on January 18th of 1971. Junko lived with her parents, an older brother and a younger brother. She attended Yashio Minami High School as a teenager and held a job at a plastic molding factory. After school, she began her job in October of 1988 to work to save money for a graduation trip she had been planning. Junko was a normal girl who was pretty, bright, and she got good grades at school. She was popular in school, and she did not use drugs, smoke, drink. She had this kind of this reputation of being a good girl. She was very smart, very nice, bubbly, and just didn't engage in a lot of, you know, the typical teenage behavior. She had dreams of becoming an idol singer. There was a boy at school, Hiroshi Miyano, who was 18, and he had developed a crush on Junko. He was known kind of as the school bully, very rude, very, you know, arrogant, just thought he was better than everyone else because he was in the Yakuza or had connections to the Yakuza. And so he often bragged about that at school, and he kind of thought, you know, everyone should fear him, and he could get whatever he wanted if he would bring up his connections to the Yakuza. And if you don't know what the Yakuza is, they are essentially an organized crime group, kind of similar to the American Mafia or the mob, with their primary territory being in Japan. They do have some areas in Korea and everything, but their primary territory is in Japan. And they have been regarded as one of the most sophisticated and wealthiest criminal organizations, like the Mafia. So one day at school, Hiroshi asked Junko on a date of some sort, and she turned him down. No one had dared reject him, especially if they knew about his Yakuza connections. So of course, this sparked a serious anger in him towards Junko. Because as far as I know, I mean, like I said, no one rejected him. Everyone was afraid of him. He was a bully. You know, he got what he wanted as soon as he would bring up the Yakuza. But Junko was brave enough to say, no, I don't want to take you on a date. She was a very sweet girl, and he was a, you know, big, mean bully, and obviously not her type. And that's fine. You don't have to accept a date just because someone scares you into it. So Hiroshi and his friend, Nobuharu Minato, he was 16, often wandered the streets of Misada, Saitama, since they were practiced criminals at this time. And when they wandered the streets, they were out with the intent on robbing and raping women when they were out there. So they would rob them, kidnap them, rape them, etc., and then just let them go. And I guess these women were afraid to talk because of the Yakuza connections. On November 25th, 1988, the boys spotted Junko biking home from her part-time job after school. The two devised this plan to kidnap her. So Nobuharu approached Junko. He kicked her off of her bike and to the ground as she rode past him. And Hiroshi coincidentally just happened to be there and see this, which was their plan, where Nobuharu was going to kick her off the bike and Hiroshi was going to come to her rescue. So he did. He offered to walk Junko home so he could protect her. And this time she did accept his offer and walked with him, probably because obviously she just got kicked off her bike. She was scared. And since he was kind of this big, bad bully, she thought, okay, well, he can definitely protect me. But she was not aware that he was actually guiding her to this warehouse where he was going to go in and rape her. So he did take her into the warehouse, and after raping Junko, Hiroshi called his friends to brag about the ordeal. So he obviously got a hold of Nobuharu again, and then he contacted Jo Ogura, who was 17, and Yasushi Watanabe, who was 17 as well. Some sources say 18 for one of those as well, but I found that one was 17, one was 16, and two were 18 as far as I know, but this says both were 17. But either way, they were all considered minors in the eyes of Japanese law. So he called these three friends to help him hide Junko and to keep her captive. They all agreed to help him. So when the other three boys got there, they also decided to rape Junko. Junko was not the first girl to be gang raped by this group of four boys. Another victim, not long before Junko, had been caught and later released. The women before had not rejected Hiroshi's romantic advances, however, so this is kind of what made Junko's case unique, because the other women were either, maybe they were on a date with Hiroshi, or maybe he picked them up off the street, you know, so they hadn't severely angered him to the point where he really wanted to get back at her. So he did that with Junko because she turned him down. So this is what makes all the other cases of those four boys different from Junko's. So the boys wanted to keep Junko captive for a longer period of time so they could continuously exploit her, torture her, do whatever they wanted to her. So they decided to take her to a vacant house that Nobuharu's family owned in a place called Adachi, Tokyo. Some sources say this home was vacant. Other sources say that the family did live there, or maybe they took her to the family home. But for a while, as far as I know, the parents maybe stayed there. They were there and they were aware of Junko's presence. Of course, she complied because she was told that she would be taken there, and they threatened her and said they would kill her family if she didn't comply with them. So she did comply with her orders. After 2 days of Junko missing, her family contacted the police about their daughter missing. The boys had forced Junko to call home and tell her family that she ran away to stay with friends and that she was safe, she was fine, she just ran away, she didn't want to be at home anymore. Now, obviously, that's not the case, but they forced her, they got her on the phone, she told her family that, and so, you know, the police kind of backed off because of this. They thought she was fine. This call actually hindered basically any responsibility of rescue for her. When Nobuharu's parents were around at this home, he forced Junko to pose as his girlfriend. And then they eventually kind of realized that something wasn't right about the situation. I'm not sure if they saw, obviously, any wounds or anything on her or the way she was acting. But I do know that at one point she did ask them for help. She begged them for help. But Nobuharu threatened his parents, saying that the Yakuza would come after them as well. So they kept quiet about Junko. And apparently, at one point, it was said that they lived in kind of this alarming ignorance of the real horror story, you know, the real life horror story that was actually unfolding at their home. So they kind of knew that she was maybe being held against her will, but they didn't really know the extent of what these boys had been doing to her every day. But either way, they ignored her. They ignored her cries for help, and they just kind of, you know, lived their lives. So the 44 days spent by her in this home were filled with absolute torture and unimaginable pain. Like I said, I'm not downplaying the other two cases before this one, but when you think those are bad and you kind of, you hear this one, it's a whole new I mean, it gives a whole new meaning to torture. And I just could not absolutely imagine. I couldn't imagine the other two, especially the Kellyanne Bates one. I mean, either one, but this one, it's bad. So she spent 44 days there. She was constantly raped by the four boys. And it was said that over 100 different Yakuza members would be brought in and they would also have their way with her. She was raped a total of 400 to 500 times in her 44-day captivity. She was sodomized, beaten, and starved. The men would often kind of amuse themselves. They would make Junko kind of get naked and dance in front of them and masturbate in front of them. The thing is, they say that she was kept naked the entire captivity, just kind of as a, like a degradation technique where they felt that, you know, it was more degrading to just keep her naked all the time. And then if they wanted to do something to her, she was right there. She was already naked. So that's pretty disgusting. They did not just stop at raping her or making her masturbate in front of them. They stuck various objects into her vagina and anus, such as scissors, a bottle, iron bars, a light bulb that was actually lit and it was hot and it exploded apparently, grilled chicken skewers, roasting needles, and they lit fireworks that actually went off or exploded inside of her. So her internal organs in terms of her intestines and rectal area and her vaginal area and her woman organs, her female organs, basically endured so much trauma that she eventually just lost all control of her bladder and her bowel movements. And sometimes the boys would just become too disgusted by her to continue sexually assaulting her. Obviously, she would urinate and defecate on herself and they would just kind of be disgusted. So they would just beat her instead. And the severity of the beatings obviously increased at this point. They were mad about it, you know, that she was urinating and defecating on herself. And I guess she began to develop a smell. So the men often would urinate on her. They hung her from the ceiling to use as a punching bag. They would crush her stomach with dumbbells. They smashed her face against the cement floor, beat her with golf clubs, iron rods, forced her to eat live cockroaches, and actually drink her own urine. And they made her sleep naked on the balcony during winter and stuck her in a freezer for hours. And at one point, they twisted off one of her nipples with pliers. At one point, about 20 days into her torture, Junko was able to dial an emergency number, but before she could say anything, the boys snatched the phone away from her and hung up. And of course, they were angry, so she got punished for this. Her punishment for calling emergency services was to have lighter fluid poured onto her legs and feet, and they were set on fire. And the boys would do this as kind of like a torture. They would set her on fire, let her burn a little bit, and then put it out before, you know, it killed her or anything of that nature. They burned her eyelids with lighters and hot wax, and they smashed her fingers. At one point when she was being hanged from the ceiling as a punching bag, her nose began bleeding so badly that she could only breathe out of her mouth. By December 10th of 1988, she was unable to walk properly because of these severe leg burns, so she was beaten with bamboo sticks and golf clubs, and her hands were smashed with dumbbells. And I guess when this happened, they cracked her nails in a way that they say would have just caused an excruciating, extensive amount of pain. I assume like her fingernails were maybe bent back, something of that nature from the dumbbells. So she got extra punished for, you know, not being able to walk properly and not being able to use the restroom properly. A few days later, she was stabbed in the chest with some sewing needles. And that is also the same time whenever they tore her left nipple off with pliers as well. Her vagina had such severe damage, like I mentioned, that she was bleeding very heavily. She, of course, could no longer urinate properly. At this point, she just finally gave up, and she begged and begged her abductors to just kill her on her 40th day of captivity. Just, you know, get it over with, because she was just tired of this pain and torture. And I don't blame her. I mean, I probably wouldn't have survived one day. Like, I would have. So for her to, you know, survive 44 days was harrowing. It was absolutely courageous and crazy to me that her body did not give up or give out before then. The boys obviously refused to kill her because they weren't done with her yet. They said they wanted to keep torturing her. The sad thing about this is that two times she could have been saved when the police were alerted to the home of the Minatos. A boy had been invited over by Miyano to participate in the rape of Junko, actually felt bad about what he had done because he helped rape her and he saw the condition she was in. Of course, he still raped her anyway, apparently, and did, you know, all of these things, but he felt bad about what he had done and what had taken place. So he went home, he told his family. Apparently, he told his brother, who then told his parents, and they alerted the police. The police were sent to the Minato home, but they were assured by the family that the girl was actually not there. The police were even invited inside the home, and they assumed that since the Minatos invited them in and said, hey, we have nothing to hide, there's no girl here, the police just kind of believed them, and they left, and they never returned. The second time was, of course, when Junko herself attempted to alert police on the phone, but was caught. And I guess there might have been a third time, if you think about it, because Junko was forced to tell her family she wasn't kidnapped. She ran away because they had reported it to the police and the police were going to search and everything. And as far as I know, they kind of just kind of gave up on that. The 44 days that were spent in the home, like I said, were filled with absolute torture and pain. But by the later part of her captivity, she was obviously giving, like, her body was giving out, was giving up, and she could still only breathe out of her mouth because her nasal cavity was just full of blood and there was so much damage to her face. She could no longer accept water. I guess her stomach, she had damage to her stomach. So every time she would drink some water, she would just constantly vomit it up. She crawled from the upstairs to the bathroom downstairs, and this took her almost an hour until eventually she was so weak that she was kind of confined to Nobuharu's room. Her brain had also shrunk drastically in size just due to the assaults and the damage to her head. The gang of boys started to lose interest in Junko due to her looks and her smell. Her appearance had become so swollen from the abuse that it was just difficult to make out her features. And it was said that there was a foul, kind of rotting odor wafting off of her, which I assume the boys obviously did not bathe her, did not clean her up. She was assaulted, covered in blood, urine, feces, and they obviously didn't care about her. They treated her like an animal, so she wasn't clean. So after a while, you know, she didn't smell good. And this, I guess, turned them off of her, obviously. So they decided they were going to kidnap and rape someone else. And they kidnapped and raped a 19-year-old woman who, like Junko, had been on her way home from work. When they were finished with this girl, however, they released her. So they did gang rape her and everything of that nature, but they didn't keep her to torture her because, well, she was just a random lady off the street. You know, she didn't turn her Roshi down. So that's pathetic, but, you know. Now, I've read several accounts of what happened on Junko's final day, but one for sure happened, and there was a game of Mahjong. Some say that the boys were already enraged about something that had nothing to do with Junko, so it made the situation worse. But I've heard that Hiroshi played a game of Mahjong with another person the day before, and he was super mad because he lost. But most of the accounts actually say that on January 4th of 89, her captors decided to play a game of Mahjong with her. This part is what gets me. Junko, being completely exhausted, in pain, barely alive, still courageously beat the guys in a game of Mahjong. She was still determined to beat them. But the men became enraged by this, and Hiroshi enacted his final brutality in this moment for 2 hours. They beat her in various ways, forced her to drink her own urine. She was kicked by one of the boys so hard that she fell back into a stereo, and she started having seizures. But this didn't stop the boys from continuously beating her incapacitated body before they finally just doused her body with an accelerant and they lit her on fire. It's said that they put out the fire just in time to not kill her, because this was obviously one of the torture methods they used. They would let her burn for a while and then they would put it out before it got too extreme to kill her. But over the next few hours after this 2 hour beating, her body finally succumbed to her injuries and she passed away. On January 5th, they had to get rid of her body to cover up the crime, obviously. So they filled this 55-gallon drum with concrete and they dumped her body into it. And then, of course, her, you know, when it dried, her body would be sewn in the concrete. And then they tossed the barrel somewhere in Koto, Tokyo. Another sad thing is that Junko had told her captors that she was sad that she couldn't watch the final episode of, I guess, her favorite show called Tonbo or Dragonfly. So Miyano found a videotape of the episode and he placed it with Furuta's body. He said it was not out of pity for her, but he didn't want her to return from the dead and haunt him because she didn't get to see her show. I found several sources that state that her body was discovered over 2 months later on March 29th, 1989, and others say it was a year later, but makes more sense. I believe it actually was just over 2 months. When her body was extracted from the concrete, she was fingerprinted, and supposedly some evidence on and in her body implicated the four boys, as well as some other perpetrators. But before this, Miyano and Joe had been questioned about another girl who reported her rape. When Miyano thought Joe had confessed to the police, he began to confess. After Junko's body was discovered and she was identified, on April 1st, Joe was arrested for a separate sexual assault, and then he was rearrested for Junko's murder. Watanabe, Minato, and Minato's brother also were arrested, as well as several other accomplices, Tetsuo Nakamura and Koichi Ihara, who were charged with rape. Another sad part about this is they received very light sentences. Actually, probably the most sad and frustrating and just disgusting, anger-inducing part is how light their sentences were. Compared to what they actually deserved, their sentences were very light because of the ages. At this time, the age of adulthood in Japan was actually 20 years old and was not lowered to 18 until April 1st, 2022. So at this time, none of the boys were considered adults. The trial for the four boys began on July 31st, 1989. The boys were referred to as A, B, C, and D in court documents due to the identities of juvenile offenders not being released at this time. Junko's name was not to be released, and she was referred to as E in the court documents. However, her real name and photos were leaked all over Japanese newspapers and TV programs. And of course, even photos of her body are out there now for easy access. They're not as graphic as some others, you know, by any means that I've seen, but I will warn you, they're graphic and just very haunting and depressing. If for whatever reason you decide to look them up out of curiosity, I don't recommend it, but I know a lot of people do, and they do their own thing, so. The reason we know the names of the four boys today is due to a Japanese magazine breaking protocol and naming them in April of 1990. Since they were minors, they weren't allowed to be named in the media or even in court. The court documents, like I had stated, referred to them by letters. However, this magazine broke protocol and they named the boys. The magazine was called Shukan Bunshun, and the editor-in-chief, Kazuyoshi Hanada, stated of this, quote, "To make a long story short, we decided that beasts don't have human rights," end quote. I couldn't have said it better myself. I don't believe that the boys, you know, deserve any sort of rights or any sort of privacy because of what they did. The four boys actually were not charged with a deliberate act of murder, but they were charged with causing bodily injury resulting in death. They claimed that they did torture her, but they didn't mean to kill her, and she accidentally died, which is pathetic because how can you torture someone for 44 days and not expect their body to eventually give up? I mean, any one of the things that they did to her definitely could have killed her right then and there. So I do believe that was their end goal. They were just drawing it out over a period of time because they wanted to punish her for turning the boy down. Hiroshi Miyano was 18, was sentenced to 17 years in prison, but later given 20 years. Nobuharu Minato was given between 5 to 7 years. Yasushi Watanabe was 17, was sentenced to 5 to 9 years. And Joe Ogura, was 17 and was sentenced to 8 years. This is due to the Japanese court system being geared more towards a rehabilitation of criminals rather than handing out harsh sentences. And there are restrictions on the number of years that juveniles are allowed to be charged with or allowed to serve. So they believed more in rehabilitating these teenagers instead of sitting them in prison forever. All original sentences were actually lower than this, but they were increased upon appeal. The public was absolutely outraged at the sentences at first, and they still were afterwards, because the largest sentence was 20 years, and even that, in my opinion and many others' opinions, was just not enough for what they had done to her. Junko's funeral was held on April 2nd, 1989, 1 month after she would have graduated high school. Her principal presented Junko's high school diploma to her parents, and her future employer gave her a uniform as a gift, which was placed with her in her casket. Hiroshi's parents were to pay Junko's parents 50 million yen, or about $425,000, as required by the court. Now, I've heard varying accounts of this. Some accounts said that her family did receive the money, and other accounts say that Hiroshi's parents saved this money after they had sold their home to give to the boys and their families once they were out of prison. That's pretty disgusting, and I don't see how that would be legal, because obviously in this country, when you pay a fine, you pay a fine, and that money goes to wherever it's supposed to go. So I'm not exactly sure, but more accounts actually stated that the parents did sell their home and they gave the money to the boys and their families. So that's very sad. At one point, Junko's grave was even defiled by Hiroshi's mother because she blames her son's prison sentence on Junko, which is disgusting because the only person that, you know, he has to blame, or they have to blame, is him. He chose to do what he did. All of Junko's murderers were out of prison by their mid-30s, and some of them even changed their names. After Hiroshi was released in 2009, he changed his name to Yokoyama, and he moved in with his mother and began his crime spree again with the Yakuza eventually. First, he tried to lead a normal life before this, but he was arrested in 2013 on suspicion of fraud, but he was not prosecuted for this. Some say he lives a life of luxury, indulging in high-end clothing and sports cars, and he is still very open about his ties to the criminal underworld and several pyramid schemes which make up his income. He is a regular at a kickboxing gym. Quote, he's always with members of his posse, taking them to barbecue parties and hostess clubs. He speeds around in a BMW and sports high-end clothing. He's open about his ties to organized crime and multi-level marketing schemes that make him money. End quote. This is what a journalist said of him. Nobuharu Minato changed his name to Shinji Minato after his release from prison. Minato was arrested again in 2018 after beating a 32-year-old man with a baton and slashing his throat with a knife in Kawaguchi City. The man was allegedly sitting at a traffic light, and he noticed Shinji staring at him, and he asked, what are you looking at, or asked him what he was looking at, and at which point he was then just attacked. Shinji was arrested for attempted murder, but it's unclear if he was ever convicted. I could not find any reports where he actually was sentenced to jail time again. Joe Ogura had served 8 years in a juvenile prison. He was released in 1999. He changed his surname to Kamisaku, reportedly lived a regular life, and he was in a relationship until July of 2004 when he kidnapped and assaulted Takatoshi Isono, the manager of a snack hostess club, because he believed he was involved with his girlfriend. After tracking Takatoshi down, Joe forced him into his truck and drove from Adachi to Misato before subjecting him to 4 hours of brutal torture. He even threatened him with death and boasted about how he got away with Junko's murder. He was only sentenced to 4 years in prison for this, and he walked free in 2009, and he's been free ever since. The only one involved in Junko's torture and murder that has stayed under the radar, and as far as we know, has not reoffended, is Yasushi Watanabe. He was released from prison in 1996, and he reportedly lives with his mother, avoiding further crime, based on a report all the way back in 2018. So as far as we know, there are no reports of him engaging in any more crime. The saddest part, and a true statement, is, quote, if the goal of the Japanese juvenile system was to reform delinquent offenders, not punish them, its efforts in the Junko Furuta case were an abject failure and a defeat of the juvenile law, end quote. Junko's case did not lead to reforms, but a case in 1997 involving a 14-year-old boy killing 2 elementary school children and seriously injuring 3 others did. Japan's juvenile law was changed in 2000, where the age a juvenile could be tried for a crime was lowered from 16 to 14, but still. They can be tried, but that doesn't mean they're going to be sentenced to long, because all of the boys in this case were 16 and above, and they were not sentenced to near long enough. In 2009, Japan introduced something called lay judges into criminal courts. This is similar to a jury in the United States. They're randomly selected from the community. They preside in trials alongside the professional judges. In 2010, a minor was sentenced to death for the first time in history in Japan by a panel that actually included a lay judge. In closing, I will leave you with Junko's memorial address from one of her friends that I played in the beginning in Japanese. Jun Chan, welcome back. I never imagined we would see you again this way. You must have been in so much pain, so much suffering. The hobby we all made for the school festival looked really good on you. We will never forget you. I heard the principal presented you with a graduation certificate. So we graduated together, all of us. Jun Chan, there is no more pain, no more suffering. Please rest in peace, end quote. This case absolutely killed me. I cannot explain enough how inhumane and how vile it is. And if this doesn't break your heart, you just might not be human. Thank you for listening once again. And if you would like, please listen on Spotify and leave a review. Since this is now the main platform I'm hosting on, I am still hosting on Apple Podcasts, Amazon, Stitcher, and many others. If you could please leave a rating, review, and subscribe on whatever platform you get your podcasts. Thank you again, and until next time.